Blog Talk Radio.
All right. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Behind the Blue Curtain. We're going to do something again. We didn't come in with a specific topic because there's just so much going on. And seeing that this is our show, everybody's going to just chime in and bring in what they want. If you guys want to call in, 646-716-4621, press 1 when you can hear the show. Be mindful of your background noise. We'll get you in. Hey, Brother Billy Brown over on Facebook. Appreciate everybody in Facebook land being here, Waco, Texas, ATL, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Appreciate everybody joining in. Let's go around and say good morning to everybody, and you guys go at your own leisure. Whoever wants to go first.
Hello, first. Good morning.
Hi. Happy Saturday.
Hi. Welcome back.
Thank you. I'm glad to be back.
All right. All right. Who's next?
Hi.
Joe.
What?
Good morning.
Good morning. Let's get this going. Let's get this up and go rolling. There's a lot of spiciness today. I can tell.
Okay. All right. We can do that. Big John, how are you?
Yeah, I'm with Joe, and I'm gonna keep it short, like Dr. Christie. Let's get it rocking and rolling. And I think we might want to skip Izzy, man, because Izzy looks like he got some things he might want to vent this morning. So I don't know. Should we go to Izzy yet?
Oh yeah, we're gonna start out hot. We're gonna go to Izzy, but I gotta say, if to my people down in Waco, Joe, you and John, try not to laugh for this. If y'all smelled something burning yesterday, it was a barbecue. So I'll leave it alone after that. Good morning, Izzy. What's up?
Not much. Good morning, everyone. Happy to be here. I'm less angry than I was yesterday. I was kind of pissed off yesterday. This morning I'm a little bit better, despite my dog's efforts to woke me up by crapping on the floor. Which is great. But happy to be here. Just, you know, just the usual crap. I guess I'm getting. I feel like I'm going insane and I'm trapped in a loop. As you guys know, the DOJ just rolled out their new revamped plan for police reform, which I've only been doing this for like 6-7 years, and I've seen like 4 new revamped plans. That it's all it's voluntary. They're starting a new revamped plan to have police departments reform voluntarily, and they have a budget of $5 million. For the entire fucking country.
56 feet.
18,000 police departments, almost 500,000 police officers, $5 million, and it's voluntary. Because, you know, police departments just, you know, they really, when voluntarily, they just do all the changes. Everything they do is completely voluntary. So there's that. Here in New York, we've got our revamped gun squad who are going to be safer because they're wearing jackets that identify them, and they're going to be trained for a week, and they're doing a rigorous hiring and recruitment to make sure they get the best officers for this unit that has been one of the quarterbacks for stop and frisk and had to be disbanded in 2020 because they couldn't stop beating the shit out of people and getting caught in misconduct issues. But, you know, we're going to bring them back and give them new jackets, so that'll change everything. And then just to double it down on that, over here in Brooklyn, in my neighborhood, in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, we have a precinct that has a Hemingway quote on their wall about hunting people. And about how it is the once you hunt people, you don't go back. I don't know. I'm not sure. I can find the exact quote, but Joe probably knows it.
Okay.
And the NYPD is defending this precinct, and they're not going to take it down because they say it reflects the rigorous and honorable pursuit and joy of catching criminals and has nothing to do with the history of policing and catching slaves. and they're not going to take it down. So I find myself greatly frustrated. Yesterday I got a little burnout. I had to walk out and kind of ignore criminal justice for a little bit. And I just don't know what we're doing. I don't know what we're doing. I'm getting tired of this country's short-term memory that allows these people to just roll out these things and say that they're new when they're not. And I don't understand if we're really pursuing, like, are we actually pursuing anything? Do we actually have a goal? Do we really want to change anything? Or are we just sticking to narratives that get us through the primaries and get us reelected? It's infuriating. It's a joke. I've always said the DOJ has no authority, no teeth, and they continue to prove that. And the funny thing was is that one of the head guys at the DOJ, when they were asked about the fact that this seems to be just kind of a flaccid effort, a do-nothing effort, he said, oh, well, even if it doesn't work, then, you know, if they don't follow through, then, you know, that'll make doing a consent decree a little bit easier. And, it'll, you know, it's only another 12 months. To which I'm like, then why do it? What is the point of this? I'm babbling, but that's me. I'm just frustrated with all of this. Nothing seems to be changing. Nobody seems to want to change anything.
But when I see your frustration, I gotta say that, and this is from my time on the job, and I'm sure Joe can understand this. There are officers in these departments that agree 1,000% with you. I would say a vast majority who, for peer pressure, whatever, they stay quiet. They want these changes. But you really run into, from the inside, you run into the good old boy system, which we all know is real. Then you got to run into whatever your supervisor's expectations are, the department's expectations. Then the political people, your city council and other special interest people that control ultimately what the chief does in the department. And then you've got these police unions who, by and large, and I'm not speaking of every one of them, but by and large have done nothing to address any of these issues. Nothing. They can't even do anything and decide to do anything and put their foot down as a most powerful union in this country on police suicide, which we've done shows on. I got to go back to that for a second, because when you don't care about your own that are killing themselves, me as a citizen, looking at you saying, well, if you give us the money, we'll investigate ourselves. Really? And that I share your frustration. I think the vast amount of officers, men and women out there on the street every day, they see it too. And they can't come on this podcast. They don't have the freedom to say that in the departments, because then they become labeled. And the bad guys.
Oh, yeah. 100%. It's all, I mean, that's the slogan. It's a high ceiling as long as you lay down on your back. Like, you got to shut up to get ahead. And that's another thing. Like, I mean, when we're talking about this gun squad, and it's all, you know, gun violence is a serious problem, and a lot of it's connected to gangs and people who know each other and stuff. But when we talk about gangs, it's just like the NYPD police, major police departments, they continually act like gangs. They retaliate against their own who try to speak out. They shame them. They go after them. I've had people tell me that they've got, in certain areas, depending on where you are, it gets as bad as bullets through windows. And when you talk about the union, to hear the union say, especially the FOP, there's no problem with policing. There's no problem. We don't need any of these reforms. Everything's fine. I mean, it's ridiculous, and it's a culture that's just, it's not evolving.
If we just looked at this from a visual standpoint, before you open your mouth and have a bad attitude or a good attitude or whatever, let's just look at what we see. The first, and Joe, if I'm wrong, please correct me, the first show of force is officer presence in the force continuum. Am I right, Joe? When an officer shows up, that's the first thing people see. Now, when you show up to me, the Blue Lives Matter flag, we could debate it back and forth, go up and down about it. Where I have my big problem is when I see these uniforms and these guys have the Punisher symbol, the skull that's gray and blue. That symbol is called the Punisher. That is what that is. It's from a movie. And that is openly worn and displayed on uniforms. Why have departments allowed this to happen? Now, I know in mine, you can wear anything. It had to go through the uniform board and before you could add anything to your uniform, you know, as far as a voluntary pin, whether it's American flag or whatever. You didn't just put on there whatever you wanted to put on. We weren't doing the Sheriff David Clark thing where you know, you win something in the Cheerios box and you put it on your uniform and come to work. You know, but to have that symbol, the Punisher skull, on a police uniform, on a hat, on a patch, a Velcro patch, and we see it all the time. The Punisher. So you can't tell me community policing and reform and you're displaying the Punisher emblem.
Well, it's like I've always said, it's how they, I mean, they say, it's like you quote said, you know, they say one thing, they do another. I mean, they talk about community policing, they talk about de-escalation training, but de-escalation training is always minimal. The paramilitary culture, the misogynistic culture, the aggressive, violent culture is still out in force and still in control for the most part throughout policing. I mean, the Hemingway quote, which I found, the 71st Precinct in Brooklyn, this is right down the street from me. On their wall, it says, there is no hunting like hunting of man, and those who have hunted armed men long enough and liked it never care for anything else thereafter. That's on the wall, and they won't take it down because they think it's an insult to the officers if they do, and it's an insult to Hemingway. What are we talking about?
Izzy, I hear you're outraged, and I'm just curious about these other citizens of New York. Have there been a big outcry since this got passed, and was there any pushback from the citizens?
Well, they're getting a lot of they're getting some pushback, but it's tough because this is all about narratives, and the media is tied up in this, and it's how we talk about crime rates, how we talk about violence, how we talk about solutions to violence. Our society is very hopped up on the retaliatory, meeting violence with violence or violence with control mentality. We don't have the patience or the understanding, in my opinion, to really push through with the reforms because these are going to take time. And everybody wants light switch solutions. They want this stuff to go away. So there is a gun violence problem rampant around the country in major cities. Joe knows about it. I mean, Chicago, New York has the same problem too. They're getting shoved. So there are people that are opposing these things, but then there's also a large amount of people, especially in certain communities, that this is what they're experiencing, and they want a quick solution. They want it to end, and they think policing is the answer. But there has been pushback against the gun squad, tons of pushback. We'll wait and see what happens. They just got rolled out, like, I think this past week. But there is pushback, but it's the NYPD. They don't really need approval from the community to do the stuff that they do. Like, it doesn't, when you've got a $10 billion budget, you don't have to listen to the neighborhoods. Like, you can just roll this out. And that's what they do. And even though this hasn't worked in the past, even though there was gross misconduct with these units in the past, people think that this is what we need. This is the only thing we need to meet this problem. And they, unfortunately, we don't have a mindset for the reform that's needed because it is going to take time and there are going to be problems and hiccups and everything. And they just, we expect everything to happen immediately. We've got that McDonald's mentality. Like, I want a hamburger, I want it well done, and I want it right now.
I heard you. And the reason why I'm asking it because, like Stan said, that the police, there's police officers who really want reform. Where are the citizens, man? It's kind of like I dropped one of my phones a couple weeks ago and it had a couple cracks in it. But in my opinion, the phone wasn't broken. So I did take it to the shop to be repaired. Because to me, it still works. And I look at, that's how a lot of people look at the government. They look at these systems. oh, it got cracks in it, but it still works. It's not broken. And we have a mentality such as that. Oh, I pointed out the crack. They're going to fix the crack. But the phone is not actually broken. There may be internal things inside. I see Joe looking like he's rearing up, but, you know. But, yeah, is he? I'm just curious, man, as people look at the cracks and they point out the cracks, but the phone could actually be broken. And as long as you can talk on it, they feel like it's not broken. And that's how I see people look at the system.
Well, I mean, the system, there's so much money behind it. There's so many jobs behind maintaining and keeping the system functioning the way it's always been functioning. Like, we're clocking in at 400 years of doing this. Like, now if you were to revamp everything all of a sudden, like, what would be the fallout from that? What would be, how many people would lose jobs? How much money would get lost? Like, there's a benefit to people to pursuing it. And like I said, narratives, like, we look at the narrative, like, we're like, the narrative of the last year in terms of the crime rates. The crime rates have been rising to a certain degree, but nobody ever discusses the fact that crime rates really aren't a good statistical resource for deciding what the problem is. Like, they go up and down. Nobody really knows exactly why it's happening. And nobody is mentioning the fact that crime rates are still lower than they were in the 80s and the 90s. And nobody talks about the fact that crime rates have consistently been going down. Meanwhile, incarceration rates have been going up. We're addicted to policing and incarceration. And for some reason, despite the fact that it clearly isn't working, we just keep going at it. We keep building new prisons. We keep focusing on policing. We keep thinking we're going to police our way out of the problem. We don't fix policing. We just call for more police officers. We don't fix hiring. We don't fix recruitment. And we just keep doing the same thing over and over again. And it's partly because, I mean, a lot of people, I'm we're like a minority. The people on this panel that actually know and get down to the nitty-gritty of it, like, nobody really knows. Because also it's not, this is a terrible way to put it, but it's not sexy. It's not the actual work and information that goes into criminal justice reform and real criminal justice journalism, like, it's not sexy. You can't get clicks off of it. You can't get the feed off of it. You don't get the money out of it. Whereas if it bleeds, it leads has been, you know, giving people nice big houses and putting their kids through college and, you know, giving the CEOs those bonuses.
Let me ask you, Izzy, because I think for the community, though, and it's certainly not to give the community a pass, but I think we, as not just police departments, but even city governments who oversee police departments, have done a poor job at educating the community on what we're supposed to be doing. And I got to go back to Sir Robert Peel's tenets of policing that many officers don't even know if it's even taught anymore. And I say that because, you know, we cover things on this show. But there are officers riding around in the car going, what the hell? I didn't know that. You know, if I were to say to the average citizen, city council person, all of you across the country, city council people, let me ask you this question. What style of policing right now has your chief said, this is my ship, and this is the path we're going, north, south, east, or west? You're either call-driven, reactive policing, problem-solving policing, or community policing. That is it. There's only four. There ain't nothing else. There's nowhere else you can go. So if you as a chief do not set a direction for the department, whether we're going to do problem-oriented policing, reactive places like Chicago, you have to do call-driven in New York because the call load is so high. But if we don't teach the community, there are only four directions we can go. And I guarantee you I can walk into most of these departments where I have citizen complaints. Statistics show that officer is a bad officer, but then we look at it and we find out it's not that officer, he or she, is bad. It's just that these other three officers may not know it, but they're doing more problem-oriented policing, more community policing, and this officer is doing reactive or call-driven. He or she is still doing their job, but the perception of how they do it is compared to the other three officers. So now the other three officers will get awards, but this guy who's doing his job, he's not being mean, he's not being abusive, is going to be hung out to dry or have a bunch of complaints. that falls on the chief, because if the chief doesn't have the wherewithal to stand up and say, we are going to be a community police-oriented department. That's detectives, that's SWAT, that's civilians, it's the generals, everybody. Or we're going to do problem-oriented policing. Or we're going to do call-driven. Or we're going to do reactive. The chief must set the tone. And he or she should stand before the city council yearly and say that this is the direction I have chose to take in the department. These are the strides we have made. Or this isn't working. We need to adjust to another form of policing. Most citizens don't know there are four types of policing, and they don't know it because we don't teach them, and we don't teach them because probably conservative guess 45% of us riding around in cars don't know.
Yeah.
And I'll throw in there leadership.
There you go.
You know, in this country, we start retiring, and people are looking forward to retiring in their 50s and definitely in their 60s. Yet somehow the leadership in this country are well into their 70s, and we don't see anything wrong with how we are. We don't have anything better in this country. 300 million people, we can't figure it out. We can't develop and grow leaders. I have a degree in leadership, and I am flabbergasted at leadership. I get so frustrated in every organization that I come into and that I'm asked to help or I'm asked to monitor or look at or participate in. It's leadership. We're taught to be good little Indians, good little soldiers. That's what we're taught to be. We're taught it in school. We're taught it everywhere. We don't teach leadership. What are you talking about? And then the people who actually do go and become leaders or get taught and trained to become leaders, are they really? Like, mm-hmm. How many of you have had great leaders that you would follow leaders? I can tell them on one hand, and I've worked in the field for 25 years. We do not encourage and grow strong leadership. And I think exactly what you just said, Stan, we don't know what it's supposed to look like. How can you lead somebody if you don't know where you're going? And there's too many leaders out here who have stepped into positions, stepped into authority because they wanted the role and they wanted the money, but don't know what to do when they get there and can't admit that they don't know what they're doing. They're so afraid that somebody might find out their true secret that they have no idea what they're doing. So they just continue to follow behind blind leadership, and nobody ever speaks up and says, we're screwing this up. We're screwing it up. People won't do that. We're so afraid. And then all the little Indians, we all sit out here going, man, they're really screwing stuff up. But nobody will speak up, and nobody will say anything. And so we just have this big old cycle of humans that are pointing fingers at everybody else, and everybody's looking for everybody else to step up, and who's going to actually do it?
Nobody listens to the officers. I can tell you, I've seen programs that they implement, this is going to be a great program. Look at all these great things this program is going to do. It's going to do this, and you call this number, and this person's going to work. Now, these are the leadership who most of them probably got 10, maybe 12 years of patrol, maybe, which is at the core of the problem, reacting with citizen needs. But they write and design these programs. They go to the city council, and they sell this program, and they sell it from 9 to 5, because that covers the entire day shift, and it also covers most of the afternoon shift, and ironically, that's when all your leaders are moving around the communities in the daytime. Now, we midnight shift officers look at this proposal that's out there, and we're like, what the hell are we supposed to do with this? This building is closed. 60% of this problem that occurs during our shift. Now, you want me to abide by this program, but it's the building is closed. There's nobody on duty. Well, here's a call-in number. You can call this person to come out. Oh, so now I got to sit for an hour and a half and wait for them to get up out of bed and come out. Well, the day shift guys can do. You sold it on the fact they could drive in and, bam, it's taken care of. And the officer's back on the street. Well, that's not working for the midnight shift officers that are dealing with most of your violent incidents to take more officers to work. But the community doesn't know, because there isn't an avenue other than something like this where they get to hear the frustrations the officers have on the street level. And I think most of the communities would be shocked to find out that your street officers don't necessarily disagree with a lot of the programs that are implemented from the city council or from the chief. And most of these street officers will tell you, unless they're in a smaller department and you have a proactive chief like Chief Devlin, they'll tell you, I hardly ever even see the chief. Hardly ever. Mm-hmm. That's a fact.
Well, yeah, and another thing is, and we've said this before, it's very easy to just get on all just kind of put it all on policing, which dominates the conversation when it comes to criminal justice. So we're not having conversations about district attorneys. We're not having conversations about defense attorneys. We're not having conversations about judges, city managers. We're just talking about the police. Mm-hmm. And we don't have we talk about a system, but then when we talk about the problems, we don't talk about them systemically. We just hone in on the cops, and that's it. Meanwhile, you know, look at all the conversations around qualified immunity. Everybody's talking about qualified immunity for police officers. Nobody's talking about prosecutors who have full immunity from everything they do. No one's talking about judges that are this kind of the same. We're not talking about them. I'm working on another story right now on police sexual misconduct, and I interviewed an attorney who's representing this NYPD police officer. She was... Her partner and her commanding officer, I think it's like her sergeant, strung her out on drugs and continually raped her for about 5 to 6 years. She quit and is suing the department. The district attorney didn't take the case, threw it out, wouldn't touch it. And when I asked the attorney why, he said, why would the district attorney do that? The district attorney is trying to get reelected. The district attorney needs the police because the district attorney relies on the police for convictions and prosecutions. The district attorney is not going to publicly take a case like this that blatantly shows how bad policing is. And this is a problem that's happening all over the country constantly. And district attorneys aren't touching it. They're not taking it because they basically feel, and they're probably right in a certain way, they can't expose, because it's bad enough right now with the policing thing with everybody talking about use of force stuff. But then the moment you start bringing out, they're like, oh, they're also systematically sexually assaulting kids, women, fellow female officers regularly. You can't expose that. And they won't. But they don't go after them. And nobody talks about it. So many things, so many problems in the criminal justice system, so many problems around policing everything happens in darkness. We only see the stuff that gets caught on camera, and thank God that we have cameras, so we do. But so much more of the problems happen outside of sight, happen in darkness. No one talks about them, no one covers them, and that's it.
Well, Izzy, we get frustrated. I was frustrated. All these no bills, and you know when we finally did start having stuff on video, right? And then these police officers are coming before grand juries and they're no-billing it, right? We're not getting true bills out. And I'm like, it's on freaking camera. Like, what? And so then, you know, we're mad at these juries and we're mad at these grand juries and whatever. Who's presenting the evidence to the grand jury? Does anybody pay attention to who's presenting the evidence to the grand jury to see if there's enough evidence to pursue charges and to go to trial? If you don't want to pursue a case, all you have to do is take it. All you have to do is half-ass present it. All you have to do is limit what the grand jury can consider and limit them based on the limitations of the law and how the prosecutor chooses to go after it. The defense attorney ain't going to say nothing. Who's going to say something? Who's ever going to know that the grand jury who sat before it and said, this is a crap case, there wasn't shit to do with it? Why? And does it ever come back to the prosecutor to the DA who's actually pursuing these charges against the person? Nobody ever pays attention to how we can't come out with the true bill.
Yep.
And that it was on tape.
Yeah.
Start looking at your elected officials. Look at your DA. Start paying attention. That's where this shit's coming from. That's where it's not coming from. But they just tied their hands and pointed at the jury. Come on, man. You're absolutely right. There's a lot of shit that goes on in the dark.
Speaking of juries, I mean, let's talk about, let's not forget the fact that something like 95% of cases are handled in plea deals. They don't go before a jury. Jury trials are actually a rarity nowadays.
95 to 97% of all cases are cut out. It's the only way our system works. If everybody stopped taking plea deals, our whole system would come to a
crash. Right. Yeah.
They cannot manage the sheer number of cases. That would be
a good thing. Yeah, they can't deal with it. They can't handle people actually invoking their constitutional right to trial. They can't handle it. It's an assembly line, and it's backed up. It's that scene I Love Lucy. Yeah.
why do you think that most cases don't go to trial?
People won't do it because they don't want the punishment. They get threatened with 30 years in jail, but if you take this plea bargain, we'll let you out. Oh, you can get out on parole. You can get out on probation. We'll give you probation for 9 years. As long as you stay clear, then you'll be good. Oh, wait, if it's 8 years and 363 days and you screw up, you're going down for 9 years, by the way. It's because of how the system is set up. We dangle this carrot over here. We threaten you and say you're going to spend the rest of your life to never see your children again. And then we dangle this carrot and says, but if you agree to say you're guilty for this charge over here, we'll let you go home.
Yeah.
Oh, but if you screw up, we'll bring your ass back to jail because our numbers are getting down and we need some money.
There you go.
I think that...
They always say it's a lesser charge, right? They charge you with the highest possible that they could possibly... you know, prove, and then they say, well, we'll plead you out for less charge.
Right.
They do this with children all the time,
yep.
By the way. In the state of Texas, unauthorized use of a motor vehicle used to be a, and that's how they got the majority of the kids in the state of Texas to PYC. Because if you had a kid that was disrupting their environments and their communities, we don't have programs for that. So we're going to lock them up. So we send them to lockup. But in order to get them to lock up, we have to be able to get them there and keep them there. Well, we were doing that when I started at PYC in 1999. The vast majority of my disruptive kids were there for unauthorized use of motor vehicles. Well, then when we started figuring out how many kids we were locking up, then they came in and said, that won't work. So they made unauthorized use of a motor vehicle a felony because you had to have a felony in order to come into PYC. So when they started ranking things up and changing things, you had to have a felony. So they didn't just say, oh, well, if you steal a car, that's not a felony. We're not sending you to prison. We turned that into a felony. So now it's a felony. So now we can continue to still get the kids that we were trying to get to begin with, so at least keep our numbers.
And to be clear, unauthorized use in Texas, unauthorized use is not that. It's basically you took mom or dad or your neighbor, you took someone's car without permission. That's unauthorized use. So I don't want people to go away thinking. Well, their
what
car
they were getting kids to plead to.
Right.
That's what they were
right.
getting kids to agree that they were guilty.
But
of.
I didn't want people thinking that.
So they could get a 9-month sentence in PYC for that charge.
But
so
I didn't want people thinking unauthorized use is these are car thieves. No, they're not car thieves, and they're not carjackers. Unauthorized use is not carjacking, and it's not stealing a car. It's different.
You knew the person whose car you took.
Right.
Yeah.
And so just so people know that.
Also, borrow someone's car and not return it inside and get charged for that as well.
Well, now, we wouldn't on that. That was civil. For us, that was civil. If I gave you care, custody, and control of my vehicle, and you and I made an arrangement that you bring my vehicle back at 5, and you didn't, and you called us and you said, hey, he stole my vehicle, we come up and tell you, nope, we're not taking that case. That's not a vehicle theft. It's not an unauthorized use. You gave them care, custody, and control. You made a contract with them on a time slot. Now, if they and I'm just talking Texas, if they did not abide by that time contract, that's on you. You can file a civil case against them, but we, from a criminal aspect, and that's one good thing I can say, at least where I was in Texas, because we used to get those, and it was a pain in our ass because it was what we call crack loaners. And we were doing stolen vehicle reports when the vehicles actually weren't stolen. There was a civil transaction that was taking place. Finally, thank God, they stopped it. And we didn't have to waste time constantly doing those particular cases, John. And that's Texas.
Yeah.
I mean, sorry, John, go ahead.
No, I want to go back to something Izzy was talking about, and that's the plea down thing, because I've sat there and I've witnessed it. And one of the tactics that they use, and it begins in the police department and the prosecutor make it a mess. A cop may have related charges, right? And they charge you with all these different charges. And instead of the prosecutor looking at the case and say, well, this one fits the crime, we're going to get rid of all the rest of them, they leave them there. Prime example, when I was going up for trial, and I had what they call the Joe and Dan should be familiar with, it's called a sealed warrant, right? So They sealed the warrant saying that my lawyer will have to come there to look at the case. Judge ordered that he comes to the prosecutor's office and read the file that way because being that I was a gang leader, they didn't want things to get leaked out and witnesses to get intimidated. Well, it wasn't until we picked jury and we're going over the evidence, what's going to be allowed. And my lawyer said, well, at this time, Yana, I think that we're entitled to know who are the four attendant people that he attempted to kill. And two of the charges disappeared. No, nothing. The thing what they was able to do was because I had all these extra charges, and then the third attempt murder disappeared. The thing that they was able to do was keep me in jail on a $3 million bond. You understand? So is that tactic. Then there's another tactic that comes into play where they'll bring you to court, have you sit in the bullpen all day, and say, well, you're not seeing the judge today. They continue the case. And they would do this over and over. And it's called, if you know people in there who do it, they call it bullpen therapy, where they bring you to court all day. You're around these people who didn't get a shower last night. These overnighters, they stink. They're giving these old grilled cheese sandwiches. And you're like, well, I'm not going through that crap. Dudes get tired of it. And it also goes into them saying, and you know what? I'm just going to cop out. There's a lot of tactics that are played, but one of the major things is people are overcharged. They have all these charges. And then, Dr. Corsi, you're correct. In this sense, my first time, you know, I wasn't even in the car. I was in the store, but I was coming out the store to get in the car with a couple of my friends. I didn't know they had a gun in the car. But the cops said, oh, I know you was going to get in the car. And they locked us all up. So at the end of the day, I end up copping out for 6 months probation, right? Because it sounded like a sweet deal. But here's what lawyers don't educate us on. When I went up for a sentence on another case, they said, well, Your Honor, he's a convicted felon. I looked at my lawyer and said, nah, he's lying. He's lying. I ain't never been to jail. When we think of conviction, we think of being incarcerated. So most of the citizens are not even educated on the law and how they just copped out to a felony. Now you got one strike against you because it's 6 months, it's 9 months, and you think it's a sweet deal, and you had nothing to do with being in the car, and you had nothing to do with the gun.
Mm-hmm.
A big piece of it, John, is how it's written up. The state of Texas, the state of Connecticut versus, right? When you start seeing your paperwork and it says the state of Texas or McLean County versus, right, and you start seeing that kind of stuff, it starts feeling real big, especially if you've never been in trouble before, you've never been in big trouble before. You're so afraid. See, what the system does is it plays off of human fear. That's exactly what it does. What police officers do is play off of people's fear, the bad ones. What bad teachers do and bad educators do is play off of people's ignorance and their fear. And they know the system better. And so the best thing that we can all do is educate ourselves about our system, question, and say, no, I'm not accepting that. See, people don't have the money or the time or the resources to be able to fight back. And so they just decide, like, John, exactly what you just said. I mean, 6 months probation, I can do that. That ain't nothing, right? I can do 6 months. Woo! Get myself out of jail. Until they get you on a technicality, and then you go back for 6 months, ain't shit you can do. And, oh, by the way, you don't get to go to trial because you've already fled out. And you've accepted that this is what it is. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing you can do about it. That's why when parents come to me and they're like, I'm just going to give my kid to the system, right? My kid's stacking up. He's, you know, tearing up the schools. He's doing all this stuff. He's in with the wrong kids. I'm just going to give him to the system. The system needs to come get it. And I will tell anybody who will listen every chance I get, don't you give your baby to the system.
No.
Never give them back.
I got a question. Real quick, if we got a caller waiting, let's get this caller in real quick, John, and we'll get back to you. 864 area code, 4276. Good morning.
Good morning. How's it going, Sam?
Good.
Okay, I just want to iterate this right quick. Like, Everybody knows that the government and the system is a business. It's been set up to make money. Every charge have a price. When you talk about plea bargaining and all this, the price is to be able that the system get paid, whether you paid out your pocket or whether it's getting paid by you being incarcerated. Everybody knows that it's all about business and all about making money. So none of this shouldn't be surprising. It's the same old thing, but just different faces in the same places. We all understand this. So since we understand it, what is we going to do? What is we going to do about it? How are we going to change it? Only the ones in the system can change it. And they ain't going to change it because their pockets is being fattened each day. Each incarceration, each plea bargain, each traffic stop, each anything that deals with the system. So my point is, we understand that we is up under, and we don't want to admit it, capitalism. Since we is here, now the only way to beat it is to defeat it in areas that we see and we need.
Amen, brother. Well, I appreciate you.
I understand all this frustration, but let me just say this. Instead of electing those guys that come up and tell you the same old bullshit all the time, start finding people that have a different way of looking at things. Find an Izzy, find a Corsi, find a John, find a Stan. The problem is that we keep buying into the same old bullshit. I mean, unfortunately, this Garrick Marlin, this DOJ thing, crock of shit. He says, you know, $5 million ain't going to run anything. Well, you run a small department.
That's $10. If there's 500,000 police officers, that's $10 a police officer.
Well, including taxes, less than that. But your point is well taken. But my point is that we can do something when we start putting people in those positions that have a different mindset, that say, you know, instead of saying, oh, I can't do nothing about it, yeah, I can. I mean, if that was the case, then you wouldn't have a Malcolm. You wouldn't have a Martin. You wouldn't have a lot of these guys. I mean, and not to blow anybody out the water, even Stan Mason. I mean, somebody at some point has to say, this is bullshit, and I'm pushing back. But until we start finding those people and backing them, we're going to keep on getting the same old shit.
I mean, I 100% agree with you, Joe. I think that the last 2 years have demonstrated something, though, is that the powers that be, they don't let the John Ruffins, the Corsi Cruz, the Joe Mosleys, the Stan Masons get, they don't let him get into the ballot. They don't let him get into the running. They push it out before they get in. And look at Georgia. Look at Texas. Look at all the purposeful rezoning for election areas. Like, redlining is still out in force. It's just, you know, now it's election zones. Right. They're actually changing things to make it harder for people to vote, to make it harder for the right candidates to get into the positions. It's a clusterfuck.
You know, as we speak, the country is undergoing a remap. Now, we've heard the term gerrymandering, and people don't understand it, but the fact of the matter is we're going through it right now. And yet we don't hear any conversation, whether it be Republican or Democrat, about those issues. Find those people that will say something about it. I mean, this is, you're talking about future voting. You're talking about impacting voting. You're impacting dollars. And as the caller said, let's talk about the money, dollars and cents, this whole thing. We're talking about dollars and cents.
Absolutely.
We're talking about future education. Now, if you want to see an improvement in education, find somebody that's going to talk about that, as opposed to saying, hey, listen, let's lock everybody up because they're all criminals, except for you know who.
Yeah. And listen, for my God. There's a couple of things to that, Joe. Number one, all the stuff we're talking about, the bad, like the aggressive policing, plea deals, bad prosecutors, bad DAs, guess who that affects the most?
Yeah.
Poor people. And guess who they're not talking to?
Yep.
Poor people.
Yep.
The census, it just came out that the census that they did last year ignored major populations of blacks and Latinos. Ignored them. So how are we, they're not even talking to the people that they're affecting because they're not talking to anybody who's not going to give them the answers that they want to hear. We exist in a society right now where the laws in this country are made up and passed by people who can spend their entire lives without ever encountering a police officer. They make these laws that do not apply to them, that do not affect them. And they, we have people in positions of power that don't, based on class, based on what have you, that don't even understand the consequences of the decisions that they make.
To your point, Izzy, 92, Joe probably definitely is better than I do, but around 91 to 94, 95, there was an explosion of gang activity in the United States. And I got wrapped up in that. There was gangs popping up everywhere, places you never imagined. And one of the bills that, there was a couple of things that happened. I know that a lot of the officers cried about having bigger weapons, saying that the guns that the criminals had, so cops went from revolvers to the 9mm, may have been necessary, right? But I would ask Joe, how many more cop shooting has there been since they went to the bigger weapons, the 40s and 9s, and, you know, since, you know, going back to the revolver, did the police shootings go up? I will ask Joe that question. But the second part of that, Izzy, is that there always been, like, motorcycle gangs running around. You had the mafia running around, the Klan, and all these other groups. But there was no big surge to, oh, we're going to cut down on crime and these enterprises. And what they went and did is went after people in the inner city and went after those groups and called them gangs. And they never, in no time, have they went after the Hells Angels or any of these other groups that were out there. So, yeah, and Joe, can you answer that other part of that question? Since the revolvers, have they went out and these automatic weapons in police hands, have the police shooting went up?
Let me digress on that real quick. I don't think I can quantify that, but I think I know where you're going. The real problem there is that the terms of engagement have changed. Policemen are no longer, and we talked about it before, it used to be a time when police would box. I mean, let me just say the truth. Police don't do hands-on because now they're taught to go, it's an automated response now as opposed to a civil engagement. Now, I've been in fist fights. I've lost a few, won a few. Let me just say that. I have to have my ass kicked. But the reality is that we don't engage the same way. Now, does that mean that shootings increased because we went to new weaponry? Not necessarily. The terms of engagement have changed. We have lost the ability to get out of these positions and say, listen, I can listen to you and I don't have to necessarily shoot at you. Or I can listen to you and don't necessarily have to disagree with you, but because I'm the law, you got to do what I say do. And therein lies the problem. There is a term, there is a type of engagement that we've lost the ability to engage everyone with. Civil engagement is out the window. And that's where you see the problem. Our shootings up without a doubt there. But again, it goes back to the basic idea that one thing I've maintained, and you've heard me say it, and I'll say it one more time. Officers have to understand that we have to give the community respect. They don't have to respect you. Mm-hmm. There's an oxymoronic belief that because I have on a uniform, you got to do what I say do. That ain't the case, my man. That ain't the case. You can't get out the car and call me all kind of motherfuckers or kiss my ass. You got to treat me, even if that person curses you out, believe it or not, you still can't return that favor. And that's where they're lost. Because, number one, they don't know how to flick that switch and say, listen, this ain't personal. I've had people say all kind of shit. They've talked about my mother, my sister, my kids. Now, if I'm off duty, then you got yourself a fight. But on duty, I have to take that, believe it or not.
And, Joe, there
is the problem.
And if I could just expand this in there because so the community can learn, I'll get you in a second, Dr. Corson. You know, so we can further educate the community, the listeners, so they understand what we're saying because we're talking in police terms, and John understands police terms a lot better than a lot of officers out there. You know, every time we add a piece of equipment, and every time we bring a new piece of equipment, now I was there from the transition from 9mm to 40s, and I was there when tasers came on. And I can tell you, prior to the taser, we were breaking fingers all the time. Every time, they didn't have enough desk in the intake office for officers who broke a finger in a fist fight and couldn't. So tasers did have their place. But we have what is called, and you guys Google it for your own department, a use of force continuum. It tells you where every piece of equipment we got fixed and what we are supposed to do in theory, we don't see it so much in practice, is we look at the situation and in our head we're gauging that use of force continuum. Now, contrary to popular belief, we are not required to meet you where you are. We can go one higher. But I think because we've had that option to go one higher, and I think with each piece of equipment we've added, whether it's pepper spray, whether it's now tasers and all these other inspector gadget things that some officers are using, you know, we've forgotten the major what. The very first thing on there is officer presence. How does your uniform look? Are you a slob? Are your shoes shine? How do you talk to people? How do you treat people? And that very first thing, because, John, if I'm wrong, you tell me, that are criminal-minded or have been to prison or have been through, before they challenge you, they're going to look at how that uniform is. Does this person look sharp? Do they look like they know where all their stuff is? Are they sitting there with their hand on their gun shaking while they're talking to you? Or are they just talking to you normal? Do I have to say to Joe or Izzy or anybody, back up off me, 6 feet. I need a reactionary gap. Or do I just, in the course of conversation, take a little half step back and I make that 6 feet? See, we have forgotten the art of communication. And it's really ironic because once the tragic event takes place, that courtroom is about nothing but what now? Dialogue. So go ahead, Dr. Corsi. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, a friend of mine who works for the school, he's behavior support for one of our elementary schools. He posted the other day about an engagement that you have with Baylor Police Department, right off of Baylor University campus. And he drives my car. He's pretty padded up. He plays semi-professional basketball. And he loves kids. He's great with kids. He's bad. So he gets pulled over on his way to school in the morning, and they're just assholes.
Mm-hmm.
They're just assholes for no reason. Mm-hmm. Where are you going? I work for the school. You work for the school? Mm-hmm. What? You know, it's shit like that. Like, when he's recounting the way that he engaged with the police officers, if the police officers just wouldn't be assholes, that whole situation would have been fine. Mm-hmm. It would have been completely fine. It is literally people who are taking a very authoritarian role. I'm the power, and you have to respect me. And that's why people get pissed off, and they talk about people who got beat up in junior high becoming cops, right? Because there is a faction of people that I have met that have lost control early in life and think that a gun somehow gets it back. And if you see it in how they engage with people, it is truly a foundation of connection and communication and nonverbal. 85% of our communication is nonverbal. When you come from tough places, 95% of your communication with other people is nonverbal.
Yep.
If someone eye-rolls you, broken connection. Someone's tone changes, broken connection. Someone physically moves back at a statement that you just made, broken connection. We do this all day, every day. We figure out reasons to break connections with people all day long. You hurt my feelings. You made me mad. You didn't agree with me. You fight. We find all the reasons around us to not communicate well. And when you get in a position of power and you don't do it well, that's where victims are created.
That's right.
That's where stuff happens. But it all comes down to a basic inability to communicate and be aware of what your facial expressions do when you talk to people.
Mm-hmm.
Pay attention to body language. We don't do that. But when you come from tough places, 95% of your communication is nonverbal. Only 5% of what you say matters.
And, you know, to your point, Dr.
Corsi, you said about disconnecting. What Stan said is actually that first there has to be a connection.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So an officer get out of the car, I look at his shoes. He got these real extra shiny shoes on, or he got all these little patches up here. I'm not going to connect with that dude, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because I already think this dude thinks he's a super cop, or he adjusts his belt several times, or got his hand on his weapon when he walks over, or just checking himself. That's not a confident cop. That's a cop that's really scared, want to be tough.
Hear it.
And he's going to try to sell him stuff that he's tougher than me. But every day I'm in the streets ducking bullets. Every day I'm ducking people who are trying to rob me, and I'm ducking the police. So how the hell are you tougher than me? So before there can be a disconnect in body language, there has to be a connection. So the way Stan approaches me, Joe would approach me, walking toward me, I'd be like, oh, homie, like, he all right? I'm going to see what he about. Now I make a connection. Now we can start talking about disconnection. But going back to what Joe said, right? Joe, I think that we are all entitled to have, and we're going to go to one of our shows that we always talk about, de-escalation, right? You're entitled to have a bad hair day like me. I mean, you could just blow up. I mean, you're normal. You're human. The human side of you, you may motherfuck me while you on your post, right? But the next day, so that it's no longer, because I had this done to me before, I'm pumped up. I can get hit this motherfucker. Go, I'm going to rock him. And before I, hey, Big J, yo, man, I'm going to apologize for yesterday, man. I was going, man, that dude took all the steam out of me. I'm ready to go. He done took everything. He disarmed me. So just, I mean, even if a cop have words with someone in the streets, he has to know how to de-escalate, or you're going to be in a high-intense situation for the rest of the day, for the rest of the week, until one of y'all pop off. And either you're going to pop off on him, or he's going to pop off.
And, John, in inner cities, a lot of times, one of the things, you know, when we talk about officer awareness, I keep going back to that, officer presence, officer awareness. For me, I'm 6'4". You know, I'm coming to talk to you for whatever reason, traffic accident, you pushed your wife, whatever the case may be. Now, if I get locked into that training of the 6-foot reactionary gap, depending on your size, I may be 6 feet from you. Now, I got badge, gun, all this authority. For me to move within that gap, for me, at 6'4", I'm now looking down on you. Because I'm not doing it to be mean. I'm trying to maintain eye contact. Now, you're taking that as demeaning and a threat, especially in a Hispanic household, to do that to a man. So for me, I had to be conscious of that. And a lot of times we don't, you know, tall people, we don't realize how tall we are because it's just who we are, you know. So I would make sure that I could be at a distance where I could hear them, but I can have eye contact with them to where my head could stay straight. And my eyes would look down at them instead of me doing this to them, because that can be intimidating. But these are little things that officers who never thought of this, if you're a real big guy and you stand out there, and I see this on these auditor videos all the time, you're naturally a big guy. You're somebody like John. You're just a big guy. And you get out there in your vest and you stand with your thumbs in your vest like this. What does that say? What does that say? These are the things we do. And I'm right now, I'm talking to him. Because, John, you and I pass each other. Joe, we pass each other. I can give you a look that tells you don't F with me, or I know who you are. If I look at you and just nod like, yeah, you know what's going on. I'm coming back at you. I don't need to say nothing. So body language is very important. As Dr. Corsi said, we especially in the hood, we communicate through that look. You could go right now and look at the memes. Talk to the hand. You know what it means when somebody throws that at you. Rolling the eyes. You know. You already know. And these are things, if officers want to up their street survival and the cities want to stop dishing out millions of dollars, you better start listening to shows like this or calling in and stop being scared of what we're telling you, because everybody here is bringing truth. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Dr. Corsi or Izzy.
I mean, you're 100% right, but when we talk about how much the cost is, it's not millions, it's billions. Washington Post released a story. Between 2010 and 2020, they surveyed 40,000 police officers around the country. $1.6 billion in misconduct of lawsuit payouts. $1.6 billion. Just for 40,000 officers, just over 10 years. So let's talk about what this really costs. And let's talk about how much money they actually have. If they can afford to do that and still think it's profitable to continue to do what they're doing. And another thing, everything we're talking about is all well and good. It's not being taught. In the majority of departments, it's not being embraced. In the majority of academies, it's not being taught. If it is taught in the academy, You're not getting an equal amount. You get the standard 8 hours of de-escalation training versus 150 hours on the range. What are we talking about? No physical combat training, hand-to-hand combat training. No extensive training with your tasers. No extensive training with your pepper spray. You get a hell of a lot of training with your gun, though.
So with the
yeah, and then what happens when they leave the academy? They get with an FTO who says, forget everything that you learned in the academy, especially the stuff that might be helpful and good. This is how we do it out here. And what is out here? Out here is a culture, a militant, aggressive, punitive culture where they've got slogans on the wall about hunting people. Like, this is the culture. This is, it's not being taught. It's not being hired for that. It's not being recruited for that. They're not doing it. And if they are doing it, they're not spending enough time on it. And even if they are trying to spend enough time on it, they can't because the system is designed to just roll these bad officers out. NYPD has one of the longest training times in the country for police academy. It's 6 months. There are rural communities where you can become a fucking police officer with 2 weeks of training. What are we talking about? Like, all this stuff is well and good, but it's not being consistently implemented or it's not being implemented at all. I talked to officers over in the UK. I had this one officer I talked to who's in Northern Ireland, which, just to be clear, Northern Ireland is still policing terrorism. Like, the troubles are over, but these guys are still policing terrorism. And he told me, he's like, I've watched videos. He tells me all the time. He's like, I watched videos of your officers, and you guys are insane. I don't understand what you're doing. Right out the gate, you're aggressive. You're not putting any positions between you. When you have a suspect who's having a mental health crisis, you get right in their face. You're not even putting cars between you or telephone poles. You're not doing anything. You're bucking at them. You're going right at them. And they're like, I don't understand what you're doing. And I think that's the thing we also need to talk about is it's been proven that the moment people become police officers, their arrogance increases. Their confidence increases. Their authority increases. So when we talk about, like Stan said, like reading body language and taking social cues, like they don't do that and they don't learn to do that because of the authority and power they're endowed with out the gate. There's no necessity.
But it's because we are taught.
You're never in a position where you have to do that because it could endanger yourself.
You know, that's
like me. I live technically kind of in the hood. I have to, when I'm walking around at night, when I'm walking down the street, I am a skinny, I'm 6 feet, I'm 170 pounds wet, nerdy-looking white dude. I cannot walk down the street with my headphones on, not paying attention to doing this, because I have had guys who just don't like to look at me freaking veer in my direction. But I avoid it, and I have to know those cues because I need to do it so I don't get my ass kicked. There's none of that urgency or intention in policing.
And
they don't have to really worry about that.
And I think some of it, and Dr. Olivia's on the Facebook, she says we need more mindfulness, and we did this show, Emotional Intelligence in Law Enforcement. And she's exactly right. Because when you have a system, and we'll just say the law enforcement system, and this includes sheriff's departments, we don't mention them enough, but we got to throw them in with this too. When you have a system that is overseen by a chief, who is responsible to an assistant city manager or a city manager who answers to a city council. Now, let's start at the chief and roll backwards from there. I can go to that chief, that assistant city manager, and all those council people, and I can say, when is the last time any of you came down to the police department? You're city officials. You don't even have to fill out the form. Have come down to the police department on a midnight shift. Not a shaking howdy tour on a day shift where you can wave at all your friends, look, I'm in a patrol car. Can you counsel people? Gotten and said, I want to ride with the midnight officer who has my district. And took an inside look at not just what those problems look like after dark, but how that officer is expected to deal with those problems so you can get a handle on what I'm talked about earlier, why he or she can't solve them. They can't solve them because you counsel people don't give them the resources because you don't know. Because the mindset is the police are trained. We're coming in and we have the answers. We don't want to empower these people by letting them solve their problems and supporting them. By God, we're going to tell you what to do. And so that's where the disconnect is. You know, if I'm expected to come into Izzy's house and Izzy's a grown man and tell Izzy what Izzy needs to do to fix his problems, me and Izzy are going to have a conflict. But if I come in and say, hey, man, what's going on? Okay, y'all's problem is money and budget. So let me sit down on the couch for a minute and say, hey, you know what, Izzy, I'm not a big math person, man. I don't know all that, but I'll tell you what I can do. I know a kid that goes to Baylor, and he's a big financial wizard guy. How about I hook y'all up? He'll sit down with you and put you on a budget. Now, did anybody go to jail? Is that police-oriented? No. But what did it now do? It empowered Izzy to control Izzy's finance with a support mechanism he trusts that doesn't have a badge and a gun. The police department's not going to get any credit, and they don't need any credit. They paid me. They don't need extra attaboys. So we as officers need to use all the tools at our disposal, which sometimes means our personal relationships with others who may be able to help this citizen. Now, if you're not prepared to do that, and this is just my opinion, go find something else to do. Policing is a ministry. It's not a job, and it is not a profession. You got to care, because if you don't care, you won't make it, mentally or physically. You simply won't. And it's like preachers. There are many are called, but few are chosen. Many are called. Bullshit. There's a whole lot of them being chosen that we see. But I'm not saying that that's by God's design. But there are some who do good, and that's in every profession. But unfortunately, in our profession, we have a doctor can make a mistake and cost your life on an operating table. A judge can make a mistake and cost you your life maybe through the death penalty or through incarceration. We have the ability to go out and alter your entire life at a moment, in a split second. We can take your life or take your freedom instantly. And the way the system is now, we can do it because of ego, where you just pissed me off, contempt of cop, or POP, pissing off the police. What's the worst that's going to happen to me? The DA will throw it out. You're glad the charge case got dismissed. You'll do a Facebook post. Yeah, I beat that case, bro. And I go down the road and do it to somebody else. And you're no longer no wiser to the system because of it. Can I digress?
No, I mean, you're 100% right. And again, like, I mean, this is the thing. We're all caught in a loop. We're just going to keep repeating ourselves over and over and over again, because those types of people shouldn't be allowed in the force, but they are. Because our hiring and our recruitment process is shit. We let them all in, and I've been told this. It's a funnel system. We literally expect, we're like, oh, yeah, we let anybody in at the interim, but then through the recruitment, then through the hiring process, we'll filter out some of the bad ones, and if the hiring process doesn't get them and the screening process doesn't get them, then the academy will get them. And if the academy doesn't get them, then we'll put them on field training for a year, and then the field trainer will get them. And if the field trainer doesn't get them, oh, wait, now we're fucked. This guy's a cop now, and he's out, and there's nothing done about it because you're not looking for it, you're not policing for it. And another thing to your point, Dan, is that, yes, officers need to do that, but I think we need to really ask ourselves, just as a job in policing, is it feasible to do that? Because in my opinion, as long as policing is still based on a quota system, the only urgency is making those quotas, making those arrests, doing those tickets. And if that's the urgency, do officers have the time, do officers have the capacity to pump the brakes and do something else? Are they taught to do that? Do they have the time to do that? Are they allowed to do that? And I think the answer is no. You have those rare cases, but across the board as an industry, across the department as, say, a business,
but
as a team.
But you just hit what I was alluded to earlier. Did I really hope the listeners hear this and to get an understanding of how that street officer thinks, for the most part, the good ones. And you hit it. You know, for me, I may have taken extra time on calls and cleared it, and nobody went to jail, and I didn't write a ticket. And that didn't always make my beat partners happy, who might have caught a burglary motor vehicle in my beat, or I had to work an accident in your beat, or whatever. They were pissed off about it, but I didn't care. And because, you know, my thing was, you know, to that person, I left and addressed a problem. I didn't work a call. And you hit on something. Police departments spend too much time working calls and not enough time solving problems. Calls, problems only come from calls when you get fed up from going to too much of them. So if we can't solve the problem, we can certainly refer them to someone who can. I think most citizens know we can't fix it when we get there, and they don't expect us to. But they do expect us to be able to refer them somewhere. So that's why we always hear in these confrontations, we see the officer didn't care. The officer didn't help me. So I, you know, until we...
being heard, man.
Yeah.
The vast majority of problem solving is being heard. The vast majority of people know how to solve their problem. They don't want to do it. They're not willing to take the steps that it's going to take to become uncomfortable, to spend the money, to do whatever it takes to create some kind of an uncomfortable feeling in their life, which is why people bitch and they don't change things. But when people are heard, when people are listened to, literally the vast majority of people can handle their own problems. They can solve their own stuff whenever they hear themselves say it out loud. So the vast majority of what I do in my job is I listen. I don't offer feedback hardly to anybody. They have to specifically ask for it. All I do is listen, and I ask questions to get clarification on what they're telling me. And as I ask those clarifying questions, you'll have a moment where they're like, I know exactly what I need to do. Never mind. I know what I need to do. And you're like, do you need me anymore? Nope, I'm good. I know what I need to do. They knew what they needed to do the whole time. They just didn't have somebody to just sit with them and to help them go through the process of think it through. This is scary. This is stressful. This is overwhelming. Whatever it is. When authority comes into the situation, that's all most people want. That's why people look and say, God, you're here. Not like you can really do anything, but it's just the fact that somebody else is here and I don't have to do this by myself. That's the majority of all most people need is just to be listened to. But that's the thing that quotas don't provide for. You don't have time for that. I don't have time to listen to your problem and get to the root of it. I just need it. What do you need? What's going on? What? Come on. I got things to do. And so then that person's like, oh, I know I can't even call the cop.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I'm literally by myself. Who am I going to call? And then you inadvertently escalate a situation for somebody. So all they needed you to do was listen and say, I'm really sorry that happened. Here's Dr. Behavior's tip for today. You ever listen to some really shitty stuff that somebody went through and you have no idea what to say to them? All you have to do is say, I'm really sorry that happened. I am really sorry that happened to you. I cannot imagine. I am so sorry you had to go through that. That little bit right there is enough for people to be like, God, somebody gets it. No, I don't. I've never been through anything like that before in my life. But the empathy within me can say, damn, that must have really sucked. This must be really hard for you to go through. That's usually what most people want. They don't actually want anybody to come solve the problem. Because, by the way, when you solve it and it doesn't work, then they blame you. So it's not about talking. It's just about listening to people. But who has time to do that anymore?
And let me throw this out real quick, is, and John, I want to get your perspective on this too, especially yours. You know, Dr. Johnson's order, she brought up something in the feed. And she talks about, she says, you know, it also has, we have some that have long records of bad behavior. Nothing is done. It's allowing the wolves to slip through to operate undetected or feared by those serving and protecting legitimately. We must get rid of the wolves as they are the issue with the culture and many issues growing out of it. That is true. Izzy alluded to it earlier. We are not willing. Before we tell the community, get to love us and wrap your arms and clean up, we have not done the house cleaning within our departments. Yes, maybe that dinosaur was a good guy at the time, but sometimes you have to say, either you change, you get with this program, or you got to go. John, you knew officers that you liked, and you knew officers that you didn't. And you knew, I'm assuming, the bad ones. Yes or no?
Of course. You have to in order to survive. And it's kind of to the point that I wanted to make. You was talking about pointing someone to someone who can help them budget their money and so on and so on. One thing that you and Joe did when you was in the field is you created relationships. And you create relationships with sometimes the people that people look at the least, think of the least of society. And that's former drug dealers, gangbangers, drug addicts, right? So you got someone who's struggling with drugs. Instead of taking them to jail, then you know someone who's been clean for 8-9 years. Man, I'm gonna bring somebody by here to talk to you. Because you just caught this person with a dime or 20 of crack or whatever the case may be. Now, you bring somebody who struggled for 15, 20 years on crack, but they've been clean for 8. You know me. I've been in the streets. But you're going to tell me about gangbang. I'm going to tell you from the beginning to the end of how the gangbang. Mm. So I can tell you how to get out of the gang. So why not come? But see, most cops don't build those type of reports where you remember the other day, Stan, he was on the phone with me, and the guy, the Greek guy that was on the phone with me, he called me because there's been some shootings in my old community, and he said, yo, man, look, man, the captain told me, he know me and you boys, he wants you to come down and speak. I said, set it up. Set it up, because I'm going to talk to these kids about what it's like being locked up for 24 years, and your mother is sick with cancer or whatever, and she's on her deathbed, and you can't wipe her behind the way she wiped yours. I'm going to have that conversation. Stan might could pass that message on from John Ruffin, but Stan could also go get John Ruffin because he has that relationship. I'm going to talk to you what it's like being locked up for 24 years and your family and other people run out and do you wrong, betray you. The same gang that you was paying dues to don't send you money or you can't call them and collect. I can tell you about all that stuff. And guess what? Stan has a relationship with me. Joe has a relationship with me. Izzy in his cell. You know what? I can call my brother up. Dr. Corsi, I can call my brother up. And this is what a lot of cops, they look at, when you look at people as just street people or just as opposition, you don't build those relationships because you think that you are already better than them.
Hey, John, share the story.
When we're talking about cleaning up off drugs, who's best to go to than someone who got cleaned off drugs?
John, share that pizza story, the one you told me. You remember when I was on the phone with the guy, you told me about the story? If you would.
About
the Yeah, share that story, because that's the importance of connection.
Yeah, so they brought me down to court one day, and I told the sheriff, the marshal, I said, man, look, now I'm not eating that trash, man. I'm going to call my man. He's going to bring me phone. I'm going to call my man. He's going to bring me something to eat. The marshal said, I can't do that, man, because cameras, everybody else ain't going to eat. People going to write me up, tell on me. I said, how about if I feed everybody? Tell me how many heads you got overnight. And so I called my man. I said, yo, man, look, it's 20 overnighters. 15 people came down. You know, they got a couple people in lockup. He said, no problem, man. As soon as my wife get back to the shop, I'll be there. And he came. He fed the sheriffs. He fed all the overnighters. He fed everybody that came down from the county jail with court. Because these are the people that I have before us with. Even when I was doing dirt and he was doing the right thing, he introduced me to a lot of good things in life that most street kids don't even get to see. You know what I mean? Like, as a kid, I was going camping. I experienced different things. And that's the thing that we have to look at if you're talking about building a relationship with the community. Who don't like the cop that comes in and say, yo, I want to take your son. I'm going camping this weekend. I got a couple young kids I want to bring. I would love to bring little Tommy. And who don't love that cop? What parent don't? What parent don't love the cop who's taking the time out to teach their son how to play basketball? Or I want to pay for his scholarship to go to this basketball camp. Who don't love that cop? The problem is, police do not know how to make certain connections. I'm not saying all. I'm just saying you have to connect to the community. You're not going to have this community policing thing if you don't have a connection to the community, because the community has to be involved.
Mm-hmm. Like, in this conversation we're having about calls, about officers who need to be able to communicate and everything, and in a way, I'm going to throw policing a bone here. I think we also need to acknowledge the fact that it's unrealistic to expect police officers to to be the type of people that we're talking about, given the job. And really one of the easiest solutions is getting a lot of, is getting police out of responding to a lot of these calls. The police are going to calls that they really have no business being called to. And why? Because we cut social services to all these things, to addiction treatment, to mental health treatment, to all of these things, replaced it with policing. And as long as you have police responding to these things, who, based on their training, based on who they are, it is unrealistic to expect them to be able to handle a lot of these situations professionally and peacefully. Just is. Because policing in this country is a guy who's blind, deaf, and dumb showing up to a call with a rusty sledgehammer that requires a scalpel. And that's what's going to happen every time. They shouldn't, we need to start, it's an easy solution. We need to start getting money back into these social services. Because what you're talking about, John, is all well and good. But it shouldn't be up to a police officer to provide those things. Those things should be provided by community programs, by social services. A police officer shouldn't be trying to connect an addict with a former addict. And expecting a cop, when you call him to do that, is unrealistic. If you call a cop because of a drug addict, that drug addict is going to get arrested and wind up in prison, period.
It's the only process we have. We don't have social workers that only work for facilities, that only work for organizations, that struggle with they don't even struggle from a licensing standpoint or of becoming certified to be a counselor. I have LMSWs and LCSW that are my friends that don't have openings for 7 months. Not a single opening. Everybody needs a social worker. Every school needs multiple social workers. We need to start investing when we see children that are having mental health issues. We don't need to wait till they become 17 and can lock them up. We actually need to actually do something before we get to that place. But I hate to tell y'all, it's not going to get any better. That we don't value people who actually are social workers. Social workers' jobs are to connect people. It's all it is. It's not all it is, but it's a lot of giving out referrals. It's a lot of exactly what Stan did and what Stan did on a daily basis. But we don't value that. We pay social workers $28,000 a year. They literally are the people who have the skills that can teach us the skills to mend our relationship and community issues. We don't value
that. You know, Dr.
Corson, we value them when all shit's broken loose and the one person
right.
that can talk to that kid or the one person that can talk to that guy comes in and she or she happens to be a social worker.
Sure.
Oh, we love them then. We'll sing praises and give them a little accommodation, but we're not going to actually invest anything in those people.
No,
about people who actually have a calling.
But see, why would society want to invest anything in that? Because here's the two people in society, the two groups that just irk me to no end. A is the group that doesn't care about the drug addiction problem because we'll just have little Timmy go up and stay at our cabin in Colorado we'll send our therapist up there. It's those folks. And then the other part are the middle class folks who don't care because it's not in their neighborhood or it's not in their family, so why should I care? So then you're left with the few in between who are dealing with these issues, and there are no resources for them because the elected officials that make the city council decisions on as far as to whether they're going to start programs or fund this program, fund that program, they don't care because they fit in one of those two camps. I guarantee you. And then the one or two in the council who don't fit, they get outvoted. Go ahead, John.
Yes. I want to say this to Dr. Corsi, and I respect all these people's scholarships, right? But one thing I'm just talking about growing up in the hood, seeing it. I've seen people go inside rehab centers and come back out, stay clean for 30 days, 60 days, and then they back on drugs. Is either some of these programs that they cut wasn't working anyway?
Oh no, absolutely.
And the reason why they wasn't working is because everyone is reading out of a book, out of a script, right? And they're bound by those principles of that book. But in real life, there's people who went through whatever they went through. And they found resolve. They found a way to come up out of it. and who best to, I mean, and if you look at a lot of these programs now, these drug programs, they're being ran by ex-drug addicts because they found that there's more success with people who've been actually through the trenches of this thing. And it's not so much about the degrees you have behind your name, but I think the degrees should work with those with the experience to help bring about a change.
That's how it should work.
The Stan Mason, the Joe Mosley, making the connections. Izzy, you doing interviews in the street and you meeting people. And you said, wow, you done built up and you made yourself into what? Guess what? You can also pass that information along. We all are resource centers for each other. And that's what it's about. There's going to be times where I may need to get on the phone and call a Dr. Corsi because she has the education. She has the language that I need to get through to this person. But then it comes time where I may need someone who talks a different language to reach somebody. That's why it's this. It's about the unity. And that's why Stan Mason was successful and Joe Mosley because they made those connections in the streets.
Programs don't create change. People do. It's not the program. It's the people. It's always who implements it. The program can be amazing. If you're a shit implementer, if you don't know how to connect with people and you don't know how to communicate, it doesn't matter how great the program is. On the opposite side, I can have a crap program that really isn't that great, but if I put the right people in it, that it will look like the program is amazing. It's not the program. It's the people that run it. Just like it's not the teacher. It's the leader. It's the leadership within them. Right, it's every bit of what makes us individually who we are, and we set up these processes and these programs to eliminate them. We want to take people's personalities and their personas out of it, but that's exactly what people connect to. They don't connect to the robot police officer. They connect to Stan who smiles and is welcoming and encouraging and loves the kids and high-fives people when he sees them. So that's something that I can teach people how to do that. But the reality of it is that's just something you just have. You either have it or you don't.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of people who are trying to fill positions that don't have any role or responsibility in being in those positions. There are people out here who do not need to be the face of anything to anybody, not much less at a damn convenience store, much less police officers. You couldn't say good morning if it killed you. But yet we're going to trust you to be the person who is the face of the department? But we don't call them out on that. We allow that shit to happen. We make people who actually know how to communicate and talk to people feel bad about being able to do that because other people
mm-hmm.
can't. Rather than learning from them and
there
saying, damn, how do you do that? How do you walk into a situation and people just settle down? It's energy. It's what you're bringing to it. It's your confidence level. It's how you perceive your ability to handle that situation. If you don't think you can handle it when you walk in, everybody in that room knows it. And so then you rely on your authority. You don't rely on those soft skills. You don't rely on the people skills. Remember, her brain shuts down. We go back into reaction and survival. This is the stuff that people don't take time to learn and pay attention to, or they do, but then nobody does anything to actually stir up those traits. Who's working on listening, active listening? Does anybody like take time to say, I'm going to take 15 minutes and not say anything? Unless it's a question, I'm just going to listen. People don't do that. They just want to be heard. Everybody wants to be listened to, but nobody actually wants to listen to others, and then we can't figure out why communication's down.
Hey, let me throw this in real quick because we're getting at the 30-minute mark. We can stay with this, but I want to introduce this. I'd be curious to get Joe's perspective on this, having been a detective. But we as the police can lie within certain ranges. We can lie to you when we deal with you. We can knock on your door and say, it's the milkman, and it ain't in his eyes. We can do some things. And we don't, there's no retribution for us doing that. But if you lied to the police, you can be penalized for that. So I just want to kind of get everybody's feel. If you have officers who are able in the performance of their duties to lie, to gain information or do whatever to get a conviction, but if that citizen lies, they either, you know, charged with something hindering an investigation or failed to identify, whatever the case may be. So, Joe, how does that balance out? Do you think It should be a clean slate across the board. We can't lie. We got to be straight up about it. Or do you think it is acceptable? And if it is, do you think some of these charges that we have to where we punish citizens who were lied to us? Making a false official statement.
Hey, let me try to make sense of that. The question has actually been in front of the Supreme Court. There's certain points that at certain points police can lie. However, on the stand is not one of the places that you can lie. So let's clear that kind of misnomer up. And then in the course of an investigation, the Supreme Court said, I cannot torture you. I can't beat you. I can't do a lot of things, but I can trick you. Now, there's a difference between tricking and lying. I can trick you out of confession because that's the only thing left to us. Now, lying to them is a totally different thing. Now, the courts understand and believe that you have told a lie of omission. Okay, so a lie of – there's three lies they don't go for. Omission is one, and a couple of them I just can't call off off the top of my head at this point. But I can trick you, and again, there is a difference. In my case, did I trick a lot of people out of confession? You damn right I did. I played the role of a rabbi. I've been a preacher. But it wasn't substantive to the point where I lied to a fact. I could trick them. And again, there's a difference. The courts do not accept a lie from the police. That is never going to happen, and I agree with that. But I can trick you. Now, can I, I've done things in here. Let me say this. Part of the trick was, in one case, was I allowed someone to call at smoke, believe it or not, I allowed someone to smoke a cigarette. And because of, I gave them this menthol cigarette, notice the menthol, they gave me a confession. Wasn't a substantial lie, but it gave me a way in. I did not lie to them as to what they were being charged with, but did I trick them? And the court saw the cigarette as a trick, as a manipulator, and that's how they addressed it. I did not manipulate the facts, any substantial issues, but no, you cannot, lies will not be accepted ever, and they should not be, not by the police. Now, remember this. You can't lie to feds. You cannot lie to a federal officer in any investigation. In fact, if you look at Rod Blagojevich from Illinois, he got extra time for lying to police. In fact, he got more time for lying to the feds than he did for the actual crime. So remember, you got two different issues, lying to a police officer and lying to a federal agent. You can't lie to the feds. You can lie to police every day. But as far as we go, no, I can't see it. I can't see it, and you shouldn't do it.
Well, I mean, I agree with everything that Joe said. I will say that that all sounds good on paper, but I can tell you that just in my experience, police, prosecutors, judges can, will, and do lie all the time.
I hope they prove that.
And they do not get punished for it. They will not get punished for it.
Some do, not at all. No, I agree.
Yeah,
I agree.
Well, yeah, but let's remember. 95 to 96% of cases do not go before a jury, do not go before a judge. They do not go to trial. They do not go on the witness stand. So based on that, they don't get punished. No, there's no punishment because technically they're not lying to the court. Like it happens all the time. It happens all the time. And like police lie for confessions, especially the juveniles. You have juveniles admitting to crimes they didn't commit because the police tell them to. And let's talk about punishing people who lie to the courts. That's somewhat true. But in actuality, it's not. Especially, again, when we talk about plea deals. Because they get convinced to lie to crimes that they didn't commit so that they can get the deal. They're lying. They're lying to the court. But it's allowed.
Now, let's actually get punished more often than lying, though. None of what you said I would disagree with. I will say this. At least here, within the last, I'd say 10 years, the paradigm has begun to change. testifying, as we used to call it, and you and I have joked about it, testifying is not acceptable. When I came on the job in the 80s, well, that was one of the courts. I thought they were kidding. They were saying, no, we're going to, next course is testifying, how to testify and lie. I'm like, wait a minute, I don't need to know that shit. Will anyone admit to that? Probably not. But as a mainstay, no. Here, the courts here, particularly the federal courts, do not, the Seventh Circuit does not play. Again, we had a governor go to jail for lying. Policemen are getting big time here. You see some other cases here that are moving. So the paradigm is changing. Is it going to change overnight? No. But is it begun to change as an institution? Yes.
I'd like to see that change initiate, and it's good that it's happening at that higher level. I'd like to see that change start at the lower level with the everyday man and woman who's getting pulled over for speeding when they didn't speed, or running a stop sign when they didn't. And yeah, eventually the dash camera will show they didn't, and oh, we just dropped the charges. Well, they had to take time off of work. They had to do, so I agree. It's getting better. But I think, I mean, I'd like to see it change start at the bottom sometime and work its way up to where at least these citizens out here can see that change, because we can make these big and sweeping administrative proposed changes up top. But if the everyday ordinary officer and citizen is not seeing it, in their view, ain't nothing changing in my life. And I'm not disputing what you're saying. But I think when change comes, we got to stop letting the police investigate themselves. We got to stop that. And we got to stop letting the police the police. Now, evaluate each other in the performance of the duties, do all the things we're supposed to do? Yes. But the police should not have the last say-so on what we did a survey on ourselves, and guess what we found? We're doing a great job.
Let me tell you this. We have in fact, I'm going to try and get on the show next time. We had a lieutenant who did an internal survey, was researched for her doctoral program. They buried the research.
Mm-hmm.
They fucking buried it under the title of where it belongs to the department. What's the term for it? Not copyright.
Intellectual property.
They buried it on the intellectual property.
They also
had nothing
to do with to begin with, but that was real shady as shit that they did that to.
And they gave, and here's, they gave them permission, but what happened was it was real slick. They gave them permission from the department, but it was run by an academic research, well, part of the university. Someone got to the university and said, no, we can't let this out, blah, blah, blah. Killed it. But it was great research. In fact, I'm going to try and get her on the show next week.
Okay. But Joe, we can do that now. You know, to give the information to the listeners here, if you're watching this show and you want to know just how good your police department is, I'm talking to you chiefs, I'm talking to you city council people, I'm talking to you mayors. If you really want to know what the community thinks, we did this in Waco, Texas in the 90s before email was all great and they're fast and everything, so it could be done today. What we did is we attached a 5-question survey to the water bill that goes to every business and every household. And then when we got the results back, you could break those results down by business district, police beat, school district, voting district. There's so many different ways you can break them down, business versus citizen. If you want to really know how your community feels about your police department, I dare any city to attach a 5-question survey. Just fill in the blanks, good, fair, poor, or needs work, whatever, as your answers. And you send that off. And then take those replies and send them to an independent source to tally. Don't send them to the police department and don't send them to the city. You send them to get a college as a college project. Let them take the results and let them put them together for you. And then you read that report if you really want to know. Because the business may go, oh, the police officers are great, but you go to this segment of the community, and they'll go, these guys suck. But then you go over here to this voting district, oh, it's great out here, but then we go over to this council district, it's not. You can break it down by school district. There's so many ways. If the department really wants to know how good they're doing and the city wants to know, I challenge you, do that survey and attach it to the water bill and watch
and
see
the
results.
All they have to do is get with the university. They will go through the institutional review board for them. They will come up with questions. They will assess psychological threats to the people. Because here's the thing, whenever you ask people questions, there's always potential psychological risk. And so we have institutional review boards. When we start asking people questions that could upset them, you have to identify and make sure that those questions are posed correctly. So
right. But only,
any department out here,
but the thing is,
all
but,
they have to do is get with the university.
Right, but with the university, but universities tend to put out long, deep, theoretical. No, it's got to be only just five questions. People are not.
We can be five. No, we can be short and sweet.
Because they're not going to hold their attention that long.
Standpoint.
Yeah,
but
they just want to say,
one,
yeah,
as
I challenge any
city
to do that. I challenge them to do that. If you want to know how good your police department is, your city council is, your school district or your school board is, I dare you. Do those surveys and you'll find out.
But it's just like what Izzy said, though, about the DOJ. It's all volunteering, right? So if you voluntarily do something, then you have to admit there's a problem. And I think that that's where people are afraid. Leaders are afraid to come up and say, hey, on my watch, there's a problem. Because number one, you've identified there's a problem on your watch. Number two, you've got to figure out how to fix it. Now you need to put in the plan to fix it, right? And so we tend to, with these long lines of people, you know, however many chiefs came before, we can say, oh, that was under a different regime. Doesn't matter. It's still your people. It's still your department, and you're still the figurehead. So a lot of this is just people admitting and acknowledging that there might be a problem, and then let's check and see. And most people just don't want the outcome from it. They just aren't willing to take a look at it. I did want to mention one more thing to y'all that kind of ties into this, but I didn't bring it up earlier. So there was a story that came out of Waco about it's the University Club apartment on Martin Luther King. So it's on MLK. So for those of y'all not familiar with Waco, you can imagine. This is University Club Apartments on MLK. There's this notice that came out yesterday or the day before yesterday that a truck had run into the electrical line of this apartment complex and took out the electricity. 2 days later, every single person within that apartment complex got a notice that said that their lease was being terminated, and they had 7 days to move. So I'm like, what do you mean? So a truck runs into an electrical line, you lose electricity to the apartments, now everyone in the apartment has to move? And these are black and brown people. What do you mean everyone in the entire apartment complex has to move? So I go do a little research. This is what the people said. They cited a code issue within Texas that said if the premises are unlivable and those circumstances are not caused by the conflict, then they can terminate notice before the repairs are completed and send everybody out. I have no personal knowledge about any of this. This is just Corsi, not even Dr. Behavior, giving her two cents on this. But is it possible that this particular owner of this apartment complex has figured out, do you have somebody go run your truck into the electricity and you take out the electrical system and then you move every single tenant that is in that place? You give them no due process. All you give them is 7 days notice to say you must find somewhere else to live within 7 days. This is exactly what's happening in Waco right now in 2022 off in MLK. All of those people out of that apartment complex had 7 days to find somewhere else to live, and it's legal.
Let me ask you one question, Doc. Mm-hmm. Is there redevelopment going on in the area?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I'm done.
If it walks like a duck, quacks like a duck.
I got you.
I got you.
So, as we now found out, so under this particular statement, if the apartment complex is not responsible for the unlivable conditions, then they can clear out that entire apartment complex before they actually replace it or repair it. So pay attention to these rules that were set up by the people who actually benefit from the rules. Somebody's figured out how our codes work in the state of Texas, and they just figured out how to clear out about 40 apartments over there.
Wouldn't happen to be the apartments down on the river, would it?
Yes, sir.
Oh, gee.
Yeah.
How about that?
Well,
that
you know, it's interesting. It's interesting because something, again, an homage to the Is Monster. One of the books that I read or reading is Dan Cannon's Pleading Out, how plea bargaining creates permanent underclass. But in it, he talks about how these laws were made, again, to keep an underclass, and how the criminal justice system is in of itself corrupt, the whole thing, the whole shebang. And from the ground up, it is. And it deals exactly with what you're talking about, how these laws were made to keep the people in power in power. So prime example, we have a nightclub here in Chicago. It was named Nipsey. Well, the local alderman wanted them out. All of a sudden, there's a fire. And guess what? Nipsey is wiped out. The term we used to use is called Greek lightning. For those who don't know what that is, look it up. But it was mighty strange that all of a sudden this club that was first it was brought in because it was, again, under that guise, the neighborhood wanted it. Now they turned against it. The alderman didn't like it. And now it just suddenly burns the fuck down.
Hey, Dr. Corsi, remember when the power went out last time y'all had the mercury drop down low, y'all's power went out? Didn't the power go out to those apartments too back then? But they didn't move everybody out when that happened, right?
Well, everybody lost the power
right
back then.
But they didn't move.
You're absolutely right. But I really sat there and I'm like, so is that all it takes? Is you just gotta pay somebody to go run a truck through electrical lines and take out all the electrical power to an apartment complex? And under this statute, you can forcibly force everyone to move out of that place within 7 days and take back up and then do your repairs, and then you can re-inhabit your club.
Yeah, apparently. An act of God. Yeah. Because another thing that Dan Cannon's book points out, and I'm actually interviewing him on Monday, is that our justice system – at a certain point, became an economic system.
Yes.
It became about money. And all the principles, all the laws, all the enforcement is done on an economic philosophy. That's it.
And you can see it. Let's do this.
Yeah.
In the interest.
And one thing I will say also, when we're talking about, you know, like Stan said with that, doing that survey and stuff like that, another thing that I'll say, and this is from a journalistic perspective, to anybody, just so we're clear, anybody can access FOIA. Anyone can do a Freedom of Information request. Anyone. You get an entire community together. Each one of you can write one of those things asking for the exact same thing. And it might take some time, but they have to look into it. And you have to push for it, but anyone can do it. So I think, I mean, what would happen there? Like Sam Survey, what would happen if an entire community got together, like a community of 1,000 people got together, and each one of them issued a FOIA request for one specific thing? Try it. See what will happen.
Well, with that, let's pass around and get our final thoughts in. Dr. Corson, we're going to start with you because we're glad to have you back. You've been on a hiatus.
I'm so glad.
See, I'm using big words. I can sound like Joe. A hiatus.
I'm officially a Reiki practitioner, by the way. I'm a Reiki energy practitioner. That's what I did 2 weeks.
Me too. I had to rake some leaves out of my backyard yesterday.
I got lots of heat in. So, as always, I enjoy these conversations. The last little bit that I'll leave with everybody is personal responsibility. It's easy to bitch about things. It's really hard to change it if you don't have a trial. So if you're going to complain, put as much effort as you are complaining into actually creating some sort of change about it, because if not, you're just wasting energy and hope and breath. Thank y'all for an amazing show this week.
All right. Big time.
I have nothing left, man.
Come on, man.
I want Izzy to go out with a bang, so I want to give my time to my brother Izzy, because I think he's still got a little bit more to get off his chest, because he called Joe the Is Meister, or the Is what?
is monster.
Hey, you know what?
The feed is monster, man. Let's go.
You know what they say? It is what it is. It's nice to take us out, brother.
Oh man, I like I said, I'm tired. I'm fighting against burnout. We just keep thinking the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. We keep doing the same stuff over and over again. If we keep investing in policing over investing in communities, if we have more passion for building prisons and punishing people and improving and funding policing than we do for funding housing programs, funding mental health programs, funding drug treatment programs, we're going to keep running into this problem. It's going to keep happening. As long as we keep embracing punitive, retributional systems over actually rehabilitative and evolutionary systems, we're not going to get anywhere. I don't know how many, I mean, it's been 400 years. Clearly, we are not going to police our way out of this problem, yet for some reason, we keep trying to do it. Like, try something new. We have to change it up. We've got to do something different because the people that are suffering the most are the ones who are at the bottom. The people that are suffering the most are the poor, the marginalized community. And the people that are passing the laws are the ones that never encounter any of this. And if they do, they're the ones that can actually afford to get out of it. And that's all I got.
All right. Appreciate it, everybody.
Damn sign off their freaking precinct wall.
Yeah, hey, Izzy, do me a favor, bro. Next time you got to give me a picture of that. Send me
okay.
a picture of it. We'll see what we can do.
I can find it. It's on it's a Gothamist article. It's you just type in Gothamist and Hemingway, and it'll come right up. Yeah, NYPD precinct faces outcry for hunting of Matt Hemingway quote, and there's a big photo. There's a photo right in the article.
Okay, got it. But I want to thank everybody. You know. Dr. Livy over on the Facebook, Ruby, Dr. Cruz is over there throwing down too, Eddie, Ruby, everybody that popped in. Man, this was fast moving. And once again, you guys, we don't script any of this. We just come on and go. You know, there's no playbook, and we didn't have really a topic today. I just said, you know, everybody agreed. We follow a thread we keep throughout the week, and we're like, hey, let's talk about some of this stuff. So I appreciate everybody. And like I said, you know, Joe know what I'm talking about. Somebody got barbecued yesterday. And with that, look at Joe. Joe always looks like that kid. That's like, I know where the cookies are, you know. he's got that look. But anyway, we're going to get out. Appreciate everybody. Fellas, be good, and we're going to get out.
Later.
Peace.